I am Plant on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. Coming to the York Theatre on the 30th of April and May 1st is the popular phenomenon The Intergalactic Nemesis Target Earth. It's a graphic novel featuring hundreds of sounds and dozens of characters coming to life on stage with one Foley artist and three actors. The show has toured around the United States, including a run on Broadway and in the United Kingdom and elsewhere. The show has been featured on NPR and with Conan O'Brien. It's an adventure story set in the 1930s and mashes up comic book and radio play formats into a one-of-a-kind theatrical experience. Joining me now is Jason Newlander. He is the director, writer, and production designer. I'll get him to tell us about this show. Visit thekulch.com for tickets and information. There are two shows on Saturday and a matinee on the Sunday. Also, theintergalacticnemesis.com has more information on the show. Jason Newlander is an acclaimed director and producer who founded the Salvage Vanguard Theater in Austin, Texas. He was its artistic director for 15 years. He joins me today from Austin. Please welcome to the Plant Online program, Jason Newlander. Mr. Newlander, good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for joining us.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
So I understand you're in Austin this morning that I'm speaking to you. Is that right?
That is totally true.
And are all those things that we hear about Austin being such a hip, fun place, I mean, as someone who lives there, is that true?
Actually, right now there's a party happening in my office that I've closed the door on, and it's like a 24/7 party over here. It's crazy.
Yeah.
Austin, I love Austin. I've lived here since the 90s, and I can't even imagine living anywhere else. I love it here.
Yeah, and it's such a hotbed of creativity. I mean, whether it's film or television or in theater, as you're well aware, everything seems to happen there.
Yeah, it's great. I mean, it's a very inspirational place to be an artist because you have just so many of your peers are doing such amazing work.
So was it in Austin where the Intergalactic Nemesis began 20 years ago? Is that right?
That is correct. In a coffee house called Little City in downtown Austin, long before anybody thought Austin was a cool, hip place to live.
Yeah, and reading up on it, I mean, it's been a hell of a journey these last 20 years, and the show and its profile seems to grow and grow. I mean, you're coming to Vancouver, the show's coming to Vancouver in a couple of weeks, but it's been everywhere else, hasn't it?
Yeah, it's been an amazing, unbelievable ride. You know, if you told me, you know, when we launched the live-action graphic novel version of this, that, you know, we'd be touring for 5 years or 6 years and beyond, you know, and that we'd go to multiple continents and have a chance to sell out the Kennedy Center and play Broadway and be on Conan O'Brien. And, you know, I would have gotten angry at you for teasing me with all of these things that would never, ever happen. But they have happened.
Yeah, and what do you think it is about not only this show, but graphic novels in general? I mean, they seem to be getting a lot of attention in the popular culture. I mean, the readership has grown quite a bit, hasn't it?
Yeah, I wish that I knew the answer to that question, because I would be a jillionaire right now. Yeah, I don't know. I feel personally just very lucky that this idea that I came up with happened to dovetail so well with a larger cultural zeitgeist. Yeah, and you know, for us, it's been amazing. You know, I mean, one of the things I think is really cool about the Intergalactic Nemesis is that I actually don't think you have to be like a huge graphic novel nerd to enjoy the show at all. I think the experience of watching it kind of stands apart from that. But for the folks who are huge comic book fans, I mean, the response I get over and over again is, oh my gosh, you've written a show just for me, you know, which is, you know, wonderful to have that kind of response.
Yeah. And so for people listening to us, I mean, who might be unfamiliar with what happens in the Intergalactic Nemesis Target Earth, what's the synopsis say?
Well, the story is inspired by the pulp era of, you know, kind of Flash Gordon, Buck Rogers, you know, Isaac Asimov, that kind of storytelling. And so it's set in 1933, and our heroine, Molly Sloan, is a Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter, and she is chasing down the story that she hopes will win her next Pulitzer. And she's being tagged along by her intrepid assistant, Timmy Mendez. But they discover that their story is at a dead end because sources have disappeared into the mountains. They're currently in the Carpathian Mountains of Eastern Europe doing their investigation. And their contact is really apologetic, but he's found something on the dead body of one of these sources that he thinks might be the clue to something even bigger. And it's a map of something called the Central Hive. And he hands it over to them, and just as he's about to explain it, a sinister figure appears in the doorway wielding a knife, throws that knife, it lands in their contact's back, and he falls down dead right in front of them. Timmy and Molly duck for cover, and another figure appears in the doorway, this one possibly a handsomer figure, and he grabs the assassin, throws him into the roaring fireplace, and tells Molly and Timmy to run for their lives because they've just stumbled upon the story of the century. And that's the first 4 minutes of the show. And from there, we go on an adventure that takes us from the Carpathian Mountains to Scotland, across the Alps to Tunis, and finally launches us all the way to a whole other galaxy that from which the impending invasion of Earth by a species of sludge monsters from the planet Zygon is just now beginning to launch.
And that all that on the stage of the York Theater here in Vancouver.
Yeah, I know. Isn't that cool?
Yeah. Yeah. So you've got three performers, and they play the characters. And then you have, I guess, in the center of the stage, the one Foley artist who brings all the sounds together. I was curious to know about working this show as the Foley artist. How does one get that job, and what does it feel like night after night?
How does one get that job? Sounds like you're vying for the position.
Well, it seems like it's fun. I mean, I don't think I could do it. I've seen clips of the show, and they work awfully hard.
Yeah, that's a really funny question. So originally when we were doing the show, as we were developing it, the guy who created the sound effects was the person who performed the show. His name is Buzz Moran, and he's a sound genius is what he is. He takes these toys and turns them into things like trains and hypnotism and ray guns, and I mean, it's just amazing what he can do with these objects. But he has a family, and so when the show started touring, there was just no way that he could break away like that on the road. And I had one of the actresses who was doing voice work as we were actually developing the first sequel to the project, I felt like I just had this vision of her performing the sound effects instead of doing the voice acting that she was doing. And I asked her if she was interested, and she said yes. And so I cast her in the show. And what I discovered was just how unexpected it is, I think, for many people, for the idea of a woman doing sound effects. You know, I think, at least for, I can say for myself, you know, and I don't know what this says about me, I guess, but, you know, you expect a guy to be a Foley artist. You know, it's such a sort of, like, gadget-oriented guy thing, it seems to me. Anyway. You know, like, boys who make, you know, spaceship sounds when they're little, you know, grow up to become Foley artists or something. But the idea of a woman doing it, I think, was, you know, to me at least, pretty unexpected. And so that became sort of a functional part of the show, particularly because in the voice cast, we have three actors, only one of them is a woman. So I wanted more sort of gender diversity on the stage to begin with. And then I just thought it was flat out cool to see somebody female doing this thing. And so our Foley artist, who now tours with the show, her name is Kelly Matthews. She She's not trained in that at all. We specifically trained her for the show. But she, in her audition, brought this, kind of your next-door neighbor quality to it. You know, she is so endearing to watch on the stage. And she, in her performance, almost becomes like, not only is she doing all the sound effects, but the way she performs the action of the sound effects, it's like she's the window, a window through which the audience can experience the show as a whole. It's really cool to watch her perform, because not only is she making these sounds that sound so realistic, but she's also reacting to the action as if she's hearing it for the first time, and that's cool.
Yeah,
you know. So that is like one piece, I guess, of like kind of a larger evolution, because we've been with this project for so long. I've had a chance to really experiment with how different aspects of it work and kind of find the best of what works and use just that, you know. So what the audience is getting in Vancouver as a result in this, you know, in this format, you know, we've been doing it on the road for 5 years, and it is like fully honed. So it's going to be really cool when we finally get to Vancouver, which I think is actually an ideal city for this project,
mm-hmm.
You know, to be able to bring this, you know, I mean, that Foley artist work is just one aspect of it, but just to bring this, like, really, really, really well-oiled machine in, yeah, it's going to be super cool.
And so all the objects and the gadgets that are used for the sound, are those packed and taken city to city?
They are packed. We, in fact, have special road cases with carved foam on the inside to make sure. And it's pretty funny because, like, one of the things, for example, is a box of macaroni and cheese. Like, but Buzz is so specific on, like, it's got to be this particular mac and cheese. And I think, like, the age of the cardboard plays into the sound.
Huh.
I don't know what, but we're extremely respectful of, yeah, that, a beat-up cookie tin, various kind of electronic toys. But yes, they all actually get packed up almost like they're museum pieces in these road cases.
So, as I mentioned, there were three other performers on stage. In terms of the discussions that you've had with them as the writer, as the director, and designer of the piece, do you guys talk a lot about radio and how to perform that on stage for your various audiences around the world?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question. We don't talk about it in terms of radio actually at all, because I think my actors, like most people in the world, don't have a direct connection
yeah.
with that experience, you know. But we do talk about it in terms of the idea of voice acting. And so there's a couple of variables that go into the performance of the voice acting in the show. First of all, three actors are performing. It's something like 30 characters. So you've got, you know, the work that they do vocally, you know, they really need to be able to distinguish each character individually. And one of the actors in one scene, for example, is playing three characters at the same time, who are all in dialogue with one another, and they're the only ones speaking.
Huh.
And so this one actor really does, I mean, just watching him is amazing. Because not only are they changing their voices, but they really are physically embodying the roles. And so one of the things I realized kind of early on with this project is it had to be memorized. Having the script in front of the performers was just taking away from their ability to really fully throw themselves in. So that's one, actually, big difference between radio play and what
yeah,
we do,
yeah.
Or even normal voice acting work and what we do, because usually those lines aren't memorized.
Yeah.
But the result of that is you get these like fully formed performances. But one of the things that we really work on also is using the microphone, because unlike a normal stage show, they have this tool that they can use that the audience sees, you know, that allows them to do things vocally that they just can't do in a normal play. For example, they don't have to project every single line.
Mm.
You know, they can whisper, and if they whisper right into the microphone, that gets picked up, you know. So in that sense, their performances can be smaller, they can be much more cinematic. And because you get the visual spectacle on the screen of the comic book artwork, the actors also don't have to be as broad physically to convey what it is, you know, that's happening emotionally in the story, because we have the images up on the screen. So it's a really different kind of performance for the actors than like a normal play is. And it's really cool for the audience, because how often you get to see actors do that sort of thing, you know, right in front of your eyes.
Do you have blind audience members coming to see the shows?
I don't know. You know, when it was a radio play, I think we did have blind people, mm-hmm. which was such a no-brainer. And,
yeah.
You know, but because we don't have narration, it's much more like a movie. So you would actually have to do audio description for the blind.
Oh, I see.
In order for them to truly be able to follow the story, which obviously the radio version we didn't have to do. But that's been one of the cool parts about adapting the show for this format, is being able to get rid of some of the sort of traditional accoutrements of radio play, mm-hmm. like a narrator, like the actors, the characters describing what they are seeing. So it allows us to tell our story at a much faster pace than our typical radio play, and also allows us to do things that you just simply can't do in a radio play at all, like tell aspects of the story purely visually. That's pretty... I think that's pretty cool. It's very cinematic.
Indeed.
In its final presentation.
And this is for all ages. I mean, young people can come to this, right?
Yeah, we recommend for kids, if your kid is scared of the flying monkeys and Wizard of Oz, this show probably will be too much for them.
Mm.
But if they can get past that, they will probably have a blast. And what's fun about the show is that it works on two different levels. I think kids really get invested in the characters and the storytelling, but for adults, there's this level of humor going on that most kids don't get, whether it's referencing sci-fi movies that you know many adults in the audience have seen, or it's just particular jokes that aren't really intended for kids. They're just intended for a more adult audience. Not that they're inappropriate for children, but, you know, kind of in a way like a Pixar movie mm-hmm. works, you know, where it's working on two levels simultaneously. So that's pretty fun, not only for parents to come with their children, because parents will get a lot of, you know, just have a blast at the show too, but also for, you know, we see the age range that we see at the show is, it's amazing. It's huge. You know, we'll have, couples coming out on a date and being surprised at how many families are in the audience and happy about it, you know, and mm-hmm. then people who remember radio plays from when they were kids, you know, coming to the audience. So we really get this multi-generational group coming in the door at every single stop that we make.
So we've talked already about what the journey's been like for the last 20 years, because this thing has spawned sequels and books even, right?
Uh-huh.
Yeah. So, I mean, what's next? I mean, these sequels, are these things that you want to pursue as well?
Well, most recently with the project, I've created this podcast online called Salt. It takes one of the secondary characters, Jean-Pierre Desperoir, and gives him his own storyline, kind of a spinoff, which is a bit darker and a bit more for a little bit older audiences, you know, exclusively.
Uh-huh.
And so we're seeing where that goes, and who knows, maybe there'll be more spinoffs like that down the line. But I think the live-action graphic novel version of this project I'm leaving as a trilogy, mainly because I'm like an old-school purist that way, we'll let some future generation decide that they want to do prequels or further sequels of that. So my focus with Intergalactic, as it moves forward, is seeing what happens with the spinoff Salt, and if that takes off, going further along those lines too.
Well, there'll be a lot of people in this town who are looking forward to this show when it comes April 30th and May 1st, and as you said, it seems like a perfect fit for this town. All good wishes.
Yeah, we can't wait.
Yeah, all good wishes, and thanks for chatting today. I appreciate your time.
Oh, my very pleasure. So thanks so much for having me on.
TheCults.com is the website for tickets and information. Also visit TheIntergalacticNemesis.com. Jason Newlander joined me on the line from Austin, Texas, in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Plunton.